Data Navigator. Der Podcast zum EU Data Act.
Hallo liebe Freunde unseres Podcasts Data Navigator. In unserer kurzen Sommerpause teilen wir mit euch ein paar Podcasts, die ich vor gut einem Jahr zusammen mit Ralf Kleidenick aufgenommen habe. Dieses Mal allerdings alle auf Englisch. Hört mal rein, es gibt dort wieder spannende Geschichten, was man alles so mit Daten machen kann und wie dabei der Data Act helfen kann und auch wie er zustande gekommen ist. Viel Spaß dabei und gerne wie immer liken und subscriben. Wir freuen auf euch und ein Wiedertreffen nach der Sommerpause dann wieder in deutscher Fassung.
Hi Malte. Very pleased to have you here on board. You are one of the authors of the Data Act and one of the masterminds behind the European data strategy. Tell us a bit about yourself and how you got involved with data at the EU.
Well, thank you very much for having me in this podcast today. I started off my commission career 12 years ago on a completely niche topic, which was the reuse of public sector information, which was what later became to known as open government data. What this told me, and it was a completely niche at the time, was that we in the information economy, in the data economy, we have to conceptualize around data as a novel type of asset, which is specifically distinct because it can be copied without cost, which has risks, but also many benefits. We call it a non-rival economic good, which means that I can use data and a copy of the same data can be used by someone else. And there, in principle, is no quality problem. I can use the same economic resource in multiple places. I can copy it at infinite grounds. And this is basically the continuum, the red thread of the whole data policy of the Commission. Underlying premise is, let's make this resource useful. Economic importance of data has been recognized. We've seen this big data hype. Today, it's all about AI and Gen AI. So the question of data governance and regulating economically data has become a really important subject. And the course of what we have seen today in the Data Act started off when a previous commissioner, Commissioner Oettinger from Germany, started out wondering whether the civil law, the code civils, if you want, needs to actually create a novel category or protection category. And then all sorts of lawyers came along. IP lawyers came along. Protection rights specialists came along. Contract lawyers came along. Property rights lawyers came along. And they all looked at this object from their respective perspective. And my first task was to actually make a bit of sense of the different views on it. And that's just a generic level, because when you look in what the data actually represent, you come to conclude that this is probably personal data. So you have a data protection problem. You have maybe trade secrets. Maybe the data is copyrightable content. So there's a second layer in the data, so to say, where there is already a myriad of legislation. And then there comes the third layer, which is basically what are economic operators doing with the asset? Are they trying to monopolize it? Are they trying to control access to it? Are we maybe in a competition problem? So this was a tremendously interesting experience because I had to look at all these different legal entry points and with the data strategy to make sense and answer the question, do we actually need action on data asset at all? And maybe to fast forward now to the 2023 Data Act, say we have a specific category of data, which is the data for coming all of these connected objects, which is the car, which is connected machinery equipment, which is connected farming equipment, which is maybe your smart home appliances. So something we call the Internet of Things, physical hardware objects that get now a gateway to communication, which is the internet layer. And where we say, well, this is maybe an emerging category of data, which poses new problems, which are different from data collection on websites, on online platforms, or in software applications of companies, enterprise resource planning, customer relationship management, all the rest. Because you can argue that there should be a link between the rights on the hardware and the rights on the data. And that's basically the creation of the Data Act to say, whenever you own hardware or you rent hardware, then you have also a right on the data. Not when you are a new user. We're looking now at the elevator here in our glass building. When you're just stepping into the elevator, you're using it, but you're not having an economic link to the object. It's owned by the commission and operated by the commission.
Malte, you mentioned the various sectors, agriculture, manufacturing, that you went for a horizontal approach. I've been involved in IoT discussions for the last decade or so, and mostly in the industrial space. You didn't go for sector regulation or sector approach. You went for a horizontal one.
Yeah, this was not an easy discussion we had. And the discussion goes at several levels. There were obviously the large manufacturers for highly customized, highly specialized machinery saying to us, look, if I'm selling an ICE train to Deutsche Bahn, we have a customer relationship. We can manage this contractually. And you can, obviously, you can. Heidelberger Druck, the printing presses say, we only fabricate maybe 5-6 types of this specific printing machine, and we will have to have a customized approach on what we do with the data governance here. But then you have like a whole class of mass market objects. And that's not only consumer-facing product. That is the elevator here. We have five global manufacturers of elevators that dominate basically the market. And there's a mass of consumers in farming, very much of a mass. And at some point, so we felt it's certainly not that the problem is in individual sectors and it's with specific products. But there is kind of this intuitive question all over the place, whether it would be fair in the economy, in the data economy, to say, well, the specific IoT data should always belong to the owner. And then if vendors of the ICE trains come say, yeah, but this was already the case in our contractual arrangements with Deutsche Bahn, then we were saying to them, well, then it's fine. Then you, for you, the Data Act will not change anything. What it will change is when we have a situation where the manufacturer of these objects is having an automated extraction of certain data. It's never all the data because that would be not practical. But when certain data go to a server of the manufacturer or some of his subsidiaries, and he becomes the technical de facto controller of access, because this will mean that this manufacturer has all the possibilities for innovation, whereas maybe others that also have great ideas for innovation, and maybe ideas that don't conflict with the ideas of the manufacturer, they will not have the access to the resource. So in a way, and the specific focus of the Data Act is raw data. It's the raw data that the manufacturer has, or the raw data that by technical design are made available on the device. So an ICE train, Deutsche Bahn, can just export the data because it has the technical control over the train set. It goes there with the interfaces and reads out the data. But when you have the non-direct access, so the manufacturer keeps control because it's in the backend server, which is very much the situation in automotive, then the Data Act says the raw data that you have in your backend server is now subject of the Data Act, and the user has a right to receive a copy for his own benefit, whatever he wants to do with it. Maybe he's a business. If you think of Deutsche Post, large volumes of cars, maybe they want to optimize their own refueling and spare parts management, and or you have a right to also give it to a third party. And this is, I think, a principle that we said that should apply as a baseline for everything. Now we can ask the question of sectors. Could sectors actually build on this? And yes, they will have to build on this. And I think for automotive, where the discussion is really advanced, there probably is a need for a sectoral specific legislation that defines also process data, certain diagnostic codes, and say these have to be shared all the time. What I think is difficult to imagine also for a European legislator is to have product legislation for all possible product. For that, the IoT market is too vast, is too many things, and it will never be possible to legislate for individual product categories even.
Might be better to have a legislation on general and not to focus on specific products, probably. Malte, thank you very much for framing the EU Commission's data and digital policy. You are one of the important persons who are preparing the EU Commission's data and digital policy. And the EU Data Act, as you mentioned, is one of the important results, the important outcomes of this work. And let us focus probably to the perspective of the member states. Could you please explain a little bit more? What is the advantage of the EU Data Act for the member states in general, and especially for public companies of general interest?
Well, I think with the regulatory approach, we don't reason so much in whether this is European versus national. I mean, it's an economic area that we're regulating. We're regulating data-driven services that should come from any part of the union. So the advantage is obviously that we have cars are sold across the continent, and car services or car data services should come from any corner of the continent. So I think the benefits materialize more at the level of, are you small, are you startup, or are you already big? And I think especially the smaller companies, I was speaking to the German Association of Crafts and Arts the other day, so Zentralverband des Deutschen Handwerks, and they have tens of thousands of employees in almost as many businesses. So this is obviously a lobbying power that you rarely see at the European level. They're having really trouble to get their voice heard, but because of, well, me being German, and they coming to us early, they showed themselves. The public companies that you mention will be most often be actually a user of an IoT object. I could not name one that is actually producing IoT equipment and selling it on the market. So they are more on actually the benefit side. And actually, this is irrespective of their role of fulfilling a public interest, yes or no, but they will achieve what is called data sovereignty, because they will not only have, as a result of this Chapter 2 of the Data Act, the right to receive a copy of the data, but there's another important rule which says they have to be asked by the manufacturer whether actually the data that they generate can be used by the manufacturer for something else. And that's also a novel step, which should actually be a matter of just good business practice, that you deal with your client in a trustworthy manner. You're not trying to pull out data, which, after all, if you look at, let's say, a public company or any company that produces something with this, the use of these objects, the standstill time of your objects, are important business information. So we also have to have a conversation on corporate confidentiality. This Data Act has two facets. It empowers you to use new services, but it also protects you and your confidential business setting.
Malte, the data coming from these connected objects, vehicles or so, today is being used to innovate the products. So there are voices in the industry that say, actually, you're crippling innovation because you make it so much more difficult now to use that data for product innovation. What's your take on that?
I think industrial clients very quickly understand it. What they want is transparency. They want to understand that it's only used for product improvement and not for something else, that no one will spy on their kind of business fortunes. And the same goes for consumer anyway, as a result of the GDPR. I mean, it's probably arguable you can say this would be a legitimate interest situation. So the car manufacturers say, I can use the data for product improvement without having to ask you for an explicit consent. Possible. I think that's possible. But for many other cases, you would just want to ask also the consumer content. So this is also about trust by being transparent and ask and give also the opportunity to say no. And then it's a manner to properly also explain. The easy way out is to say, it's too complicated. I have no time to explain to you. And I'll do it in some sort of shady and dark manner. I think it's more beneficial for trust in digital in general to openly communicate and have also an honest societal conversation that certain things will just be necessary. And I think that's also where I wish that many politicians go much more openly into the public discourse and say, let's defend also industry concerns and say there is positive in digital. Because especially in the country I know best, which is Germany, I mean, we have, and with many friends also, the data conversation is always a data protection conversation, very, very quickly.
Exactly.
And it doesn't have to be.
It takes it instantly, the data conversation, into the dark corner and in the defensive. And it's seen because of the restrictive interpretation of GDPR in Germany, a bit of a challenge for the Data Act as well. No, I think it also takes us back to your initial point about data as an asset. What we see a lot is that we have a very classical thinking about assets. Assets are something that are of value for me and my company, and I need to protect them. And protecting means keeping them for myself. And what you're trying to do, what you explained so well, is you're trying to change that mindset and ensure that we create value by sharing. That's counterintuitive. I think it's super interesting because it's almost a psychological question, a mindset question, a cultural question. And from what we can hear and from you, that's what you're trying to address with this package of data laws that you put in place.
Probably let's talk about a concrete example. Digital transformation in local public transport, transformation to e-mobility. I would like to ask you if you think it's a good example for what Hubertus explained about sharing data. In one of our other podcasts, we had Ulrich Wolters from Bosch Germany here as a guest. And we talked about digital transformation, and we talked about what is the new balance between the data is owned by Bosch, but the public companies will need these data for transforming their public transporting system into e-mobility. And what I see is that the EU Data Act is opening these opportunities to create a new balance between using and sharing the data between the public companies and private companies who are owning or providing the data.
I need to put also the Data Act in context. Because of its large scope of application and its grandiose title, people look at it and say, well, this is going to be probably the master law of everything. But obviously, it's placed in a context of many, many rules. What I have observed is that when you look at the acquis of national and European rules on data exchange, it is always very, very specific. There's a specific use case in mind, and there's a specific obligation imposed on some specific actor to share some sort of data. We're discussing, for example, at the moment, the exchange of battery charging status data for the benefit of balancing the grid. So it's one, I think, really highly useful use case. So it merits attention. But use cases of this nature, we have so many. So we need also to find basically a way to accelerate this digital transition, which is not small piece by piece by piece by piece, because otherwise we are putting only pieces of a mosaic. And if you think of the mosaic image, you will have maybe now 10% of the mosaic ready. The Data Act uses a broad stroke, agreed. So it cuts across a lot of product categories, but it goes from a different principle. The user decides. And now with the user decides, which can be the enterprise that owns a mobility device, it can be, but it can also be the one who has a mobility device and wants just to be giving his data. Let me give an example. I mean, if I want to have mobility patterns from people who drive an e-bike, now thinking of also the company Bosch, I can obviously use the access point Bosch and say, can you legally give me aggregated information? You have done the GDPR compliance and you anonymize and aggregate to an extent that is fine. And then Bosch is in a negotiation position to sell me this information. I mean, mobile network operators have developed even products for this mobility pattern data. This was a business. I'm not sure whether it's still a business. With the Data Act now, we are adding to this Bosch entry point a second entry point, which is the user. So I can easily now deploy an app. I can be a researcher who says, can I please have your mobility data? And can you maybe share your usage of your Bosch e-bike? And I can do this the same thing. Now with the e-scooters, a bit more difficult. Maybe they're also covered because I will probably be in a kind of rental situation when I'm using as a permanent user an e-scooter system. So that's another form of e-mobility. So in that sense, the Data Act Chapter 2 broadens the number of access points, which is then also indirectly broadening access, but it works via the access point. This is very important. It's not that the EU opens up data. The EU defines more access points to data resources. And the user, who should be a mature citizen, and we believe in digital literacy, and there's also a liberal empowerment thinking in thinking user-centric design. And the user will design. Data Act Chapter 2 is a really market-based design in its deep-rooted logic.
And is it more for a private consumer or is it more for companies?
The Data Act Chapter 2.
Well, you referred to both the person on the scooter, but we also talked about fleet operators. Which ones is it designed for?
Both. So if you take, I mean, I think the leasing companies are the largest owner of motor vehicles in Europe by just number. Larger than the car rentals. So the leasing operators are very much part of the discussion on access to mobility data or car data, automotive data, which is more for fleet optimization. I think they care a little less about the kind of public purpose, urban traffic flows, mobility flows, and also the mobility as a service offering on the automotive part. I'm still seeing it emerging personally. But yes, they are all beneficiaries. And we multiply basically the players who can make the data flow. We're reducing the number of veto situations, which is normally very bad from a competition point of view. So there's a deep competition thinking in the whole architecture.
If we think about the private consumers, you and I, who do you think will come to us and ask for that data? Or will you and I be expected to do something with the data ourselves?
I think the proactive way that the consumer has an idea is rarely the case. You have to be a hacker or some sort of activist who wants to do this. I mean, we know of the examples of the cycling activists who flinch some IoT measurement, distance measurements to their cycles to see whether the 1.5 meter distance, which is normally the law in all countries, is respected. But that's going to be a niche. What will happen and what is happening to probably most listeners here is that you will be offered a pay-as-you-drive car insurance. You will be offered very soon also predictive maintenance. So the services will find us. Also, the researchers will find us. The researchers say, I now know you can donate your Fitbit data to detect COVID. I mean, that was a real example from Germany. The Robert Koch Institute asked to see whether we can, from the activity sensor measurement, we can basically infer that people may be in a disease and maybe it's COVID. Data analytics has a certain limitations, but it maybe also will get better over time, the more we learn what kind of individual data points can actually mean. So the citizen will be approached by the others who will know, and that's also one of the beauties of the Data Act, who will know also what products give you what data, because there will be an obligation on the manufacturers to say, typically these data points will be available. They are either readable on device because you can plug in something, or you can go to what we call the data holder, which is the entity which stores the data on some server, and you have to come to our API and call the API, and these are the API specifications. The interested parties can understand, and then they will make up their mind, is it economically interesting to go via a multiplicity of consumers, or whether they rather prefer to go to the central point, which is the manufacturer, and say, okay, how much is it? And the manufacturers will have to probably also adapt a bit their financial models and say, okay, now that I know I'm not exclusively distributing this anymore, I probably also have to move a little bit. So overall, this commodifies, if you want, the certain raw data. It's not any data. Let's repeat this so that no one takes away a wrong conclusion. It's specific raw data, and there is also protection of trade secrets. So it's not everything for free for everyone. It's a very specific category, and we really wrenched over almost every kind of inch how far.
Trade secrets, a topic that was discussed at the very end in the trilogue and until the very last moment. There's a compromise now in the text, I think, which restricts the ability to use the argument, well, trade secret. Do you get first feedback from the industry how this will evolve and how it works?
No, to be very honest, this is the point where during the negotiations and also during the kind of what you may call lobbying, but I think lobbying can also be a positive way of industry seeing, look, this is really a problem for us. And I think the Commission has no intention to destroy the industrial base of Europe indirectly with the Data Act. So the lobbying, when I say lobbying, I don't mean it in a negative sense. So there was a lot of feedback, let's say, from industry that this would be dangerous. What is the anxiety? The anxiety is that it would be cheaper and faster to reverse engineer on the basis of raw usage data. But let's recap. Reverse engineering is lawful. It is possible to acquire a competitor's product, disassemble it, inspect it, and make your guesses. Why is this doing good things? This is not prohibited unless you have patented something. And very often, for a lot of reasons, companies don't patent stuff because they don't want to put their invention in the open, which is the publicity of the patent. So the assumption is you could reverse engineer faster, but the proof of the assumption of the hypothesis has not yet been given. So we are in a field of speculation. Is it really faster? And one clear factor is you have first to have a lot of user data. This is already an expense and also like a time has a temporal dimension, because you need to acquire the data over time because people buy products and then you onboard a new client on your kind of spying platform, if you want. And then you take your conclusions. So first blocking point, you need a lot of data. Secondly, you have to have the ingenious algorithm who can actually really make the conclusions that these data points and these reactions mean this. It's not inexpensive. So I think on the number of counts, I don't think industry should be too worried. What will always be the case is that industry is in the pole position, because they will, if they design their interaction of their products with the home-based server smartly, they will always be the first ones to know. They will be in the natural pole position in any way. And then reverse engineering has happened, will happen before and after the Data Act. This is just a fact, but yeah, the fears were intense. Maybe some more granular explanations on what specifically we now have. We have a relatively sophisticated mechanism where you can invoke the risk that you feel if these data points are being pulled, trade secrets could be revealed. The data points would not be the trade secrets, but the combination and the analysis of the data points reveal the trade secret. That's the fear. And we have a system where you can ultimately even not make the transfer happen. And when would you do this as a company? You will not do this with an isolated client. You will do this when you see, aha, there's a pattern. There's a mass call to my API. And the receiving company sits in a jurisdiction where trade secrets are not so well respected. Then you pull the what we call the handbrake. And then you say, look, no, sorry. We have to stop the API calls from these companies. We have to block them. And we have to renegotiate the terms. And there's many technical ways of still trying to bridge the gap if you feel it's maybe still a legitimate kind of user, but where you have suspicions, and then you arrange on technical trusted solutions. And you can say, well, come to a trusted solution. And actually, by the way, Article 9 allows me to make you pay for the trusted solution.
But Malte, the fear is also that once the data is out there in the open, you don't even know who's going to get it. It's not a direct request via API or contractual agreement with the third party, but it's already out there and you don't know where it's going.
Which is why, I mean, there's two things. The first thing actually that we had in our proposal was to say you can oblige the other party to keep the data confidential, because you have under, if you want to keep your trade secrets protection, you have to make sure that you have a chain of confidentiality. And if you fear that a specific data asset already represents the trade secret, it's very easy. You say, okay, I can give this to you, but we have to agree on conditions that preserve the confidentiality of the data point. So you actually may have to come to my server, or you may have to come to a neutral third party, which will hold the data in a sort of an escrow account, and you will only be able to process it there. You will never get it to the open. So there is, I think the Data Act allows for a lot of granular protection mechanisms. And yes, sometimes you will only discover with hindsight, oh, there was a smart recombination of these data points possible, and now I can't call it back into the box. But again, I mean, that's also partly, I would say, a risk of doing business, because smart, independent observation of objects was always lawful under trade secrets. Because this is, and I will maybe also say this, the other perspective. Innovation happens because people discover things. So it's not necessarily that it's always good for innovation that everyone can keep things secret. But I think there is a general debate on how much secrecy is actually good for innovation.
Malte, facing what we discussed and what we talked about, probably let's talk about the next steps. Now we are in a phase where the member states has to prepare the implementation of the EU Data Act. And what does the EU now expect from the addressees of the EU Data Act? For example, from public companies and from their private partners.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to clarify, the Data Act is a regulation. So there is no need for any transposition in the what concerns the subject matter.
Okay.
What we need is oversight authorities. And so every country needs to appoint one or several authorities that feel competent to also supervise that the obligations are being respected. With the important information, I mean, this is well, on in principle, private enforcement. if you feel that under your IoT, you have an IoT object and you don't get all the data you should get, you have to first sue in court. The oversight mechanism serves to generally see whether there are maybe structural problems, certain industries not behaving, or there's a specific company that always rejects and it becomes a bit of a public policy problem. So we need, and that's not trivial, and in all the member states, placing authorities for digital is not very clear because you have some existing authorities, competition authorities, network regulators, telcos, communication agencies.
Germany is a very good example for that.
Yeah. And then you have like federal and then national level. So it's not so clear where actually to put the data act. And I don't want to give now a request. That's the public side. As a second step, you have also to define a sanctions regime. This is also national law. So certain procedural rules. When we are being asked what we're saying, this is actually competition law. So this is, if now in some countries you have especially these unbundling of network industries where there's also about competition. So it's not necessarily that it's only the competition authority in the strict sense that can handle this. But we see sometimes also that the network regulators are having the tool set and equipped for that. And for Chapter 6, which is now about cloud switching, we have a specific call that we wouldn't want to see the telco regulator to actually take it because we feel that most of the expertise is there. But other than that, we try to refrain and give it. But I want to come also back on what now companies should prepare for. If you're in the business of developing IoT objects, and if you have an object where it's currently so that you receive data from the objects for whatever purpose, you have for sure to adapt contracts. But you also have to see that your IT architectures get a public front-end API, which can be called. What you then want to need to build is also that you have a means to identify your users, that you know actually that who authorizes the API call is actually an authorized owner of something. And I mean, some of the higher pricing objects have this, you register. And for certain object, it matters more who is driving a car because mobility patterns are sensitive data. For the users of my smart dishwasher at home, it matters a little less who pushes the button. So it may be okay if I am the user and I scan a QR code on the side of the dishwasher to register me in the app. And that would be proof enough to say I have actual access to the dishwasher and I can take out the consumption data. So there will be different security layers also to make sure that the right people get the right data. Because I think the biggest challenge is for the corporate IT architectures to link the data points to individual claimants. And if I'm in the business now, I don't want to shock certain industries, but if I'm in the business of renting out cars or even selling cars and I have car rental, also in principle, the short-term car rental are eligible because they aren't a rental contract. And we had long debates why a short-term car rental is actually covered because it seems really burdensome. And I give you the explanation because short-term machinery rental in agriculture is very typical or it's rather typical. And it's the most important data of the year if you have the harvesting engine running over your fields. Because you, even if it's only 5 days of harvesting period, these data are the one that matters most. So we couldn't just say short-term is excluded because it would be too burdensome for the weekend trip that you take with a car rental car. Because in other businesses such as farming, it's the single most essential data point that you have. So you need to actually factor in that you will have maybe a lot of users over time and some even in parallel. We spoke about leasing, vehicle leasing, that you have layered user situations. So the leasing company may be the first user, but then there's another person behind it or maybe several people behind it. And all of their personal data rights need to be respected and also all the data act right needs to be respected in also these layered situations.
Well, all these principles apply to any product that is being brought into the market in Europe, i.e. also for companies that manufacture outside Europe. How do you see this being enforced with companies that are non-European?
Yeah. Now, first, let me again say it applies to all companies who receive data from the products. That's a really important condition. So either, but that's in a consumer product, normally not the case that you can actually plug something there, a little plug, or you have a near field communication to read out data. So you need to be a receiving data company. But the import-export situation is a classical problem. We just say, well, it's an obligation like many other obligations on safety of products, on chemicals in the product, that this is also now a requirement. Well, and then you have two categories. You have a small set of products which undergo some sort of certification or type approval process because the type can be actually entering the market. And then you can use these processes in the future to filter out imports that because they a new vehicle type or a new kind of medical device object would no longer be certified. But we couldn't, these are not connected. I mean, it would be very clear, the two regimes could not be interlinked because every product has an own review cycle and we could just not wait for the last one to be ready for this. But we want to coordinate this. And then you have the unregulated products. And there it may be a challenge. But I think the challenge with safety is already there. So we have not found the magic other tool that others have not found yet.
There's one question, Malte, that you initially wanted to address, which is the connection between the Data Act and the data spaces. Malte, you talked about companies managing the process of data access and transparency about who has access. What role do you see there for data spaces in that context?
There's three things that maybe I want to connect. It's the concept of data space. It's the concept of a data intermediation service or data intermediary. And then it's obviously the question of when can data flow? Do you have rights to access or port data? So a data space is not an end in itself. A data space is a framework for digital collaborations and development of digital solutions based on the exchange of data. It all becomes more interesting when more data can flow. And Data Act Chapter 2, as we discussed now, gives more people a right to exchange data under conditions that we couldn't go into the detail here. So in a way, a data space could be a setting to find all these new solutions that want maybe to offer you services around IoT data. But it's not more than that. There's no magic. There's no must to go into the data space. You can find these solutions outside data space. The data space may make it a little easier to get these collaborations, especially among companies, organized because there's a lot of contracts to be discussed, exchange protocols to negotiate. And if you have standards in the data space to solve already this, because there's always the same protocol everyone uses, and then there's model contracts and there's security guarantees and there's identification protocols. How do we know that he is he and she is her? Then this may actually make digital collaborations and data services much more interesting. Now, within the data space, you could actually say, well, I want to use a service provider who helps me to build a digital collaboration. And that could be, in certain situations, a data intermediary, a data sharing intermediary, because it could be such that you want actually to have data from different users of IoT objects. So they have to be coming together somehow. As I said, I was speaking to the German Crafts the other day, so it's tens of thousands of small enterprises who all will now say, okay, do I go to my customer and say, can you please pull the data from your dishwasher individually? That would be insane. So obviously it's interesting if all these small enterprises band together and have a common service provider that arranges for a standard solution of pulling out dishwasher, wash machine, heating pumps, you name it, solar panel, all the objects that are in mass distribution, same for agriculture, that we have a certain, that you say, the good old cooperatives, which are very prominent in agriculture, that we form new data cooperatives in farming. And the farming data cooperatives go to the vendors of farming equipment and say, here, our farmers need access to your data. And we sit with you. We discuss all these trade secrets problems, technical conditions, and the farmer can easily integrate this later into his farm information management.
I think that's happening, no? In the agricultural space, it's starting to happen.
Yeah, and that's why I think when people saw the Data Governance Act Chapter 3, it's like, this is science fiction and what would this be good for? But I think the utility is slowly showing itself, because especially in these kind of situations where there's a lot of small players and there's maybe one, two, three big players, you probably need someone to aggregate demand, purchase power, and also take care of the technical things that the small party can never take care of. Let's take the example of the public enterprises. I mean, there's also, I think, a little restriction on what can a small municipality negotiate vis-a-vis the provider of its tram sets, of its Wi-Fi equipment, and things like that. You need probably aggregation points and service providers that serve the interest of a certain category of companies.
Just one final question, a look into the future. If we fast forward to the 12th of September 2026, so a year after the official start date for the Data Act, what would you like to see at that point in time that should have happened by then?
I think the most plastic one is for everyone, consumer, but also companies, that when you have now all these apps that come with your product, that there is a data share button or a functionality embedded in all these interfaces. It can also be a web page because mobile is complicated, but that we have click, get my data buttons everywhere. That's, I think, the simplest manifestation of the right to portability. And that's, yeah, most of the manufacturers also see that they could also be a recipient, because that's a perspective change we also try to educate. Like, you will be obliged to do something, but put yourself also in the receiving end. And that's where certain companies are more open, because they see that they can be in both roles. So that we also then think, okay, let's not hoard our data. I mean, let's have an open perspective, and let's certainly not use Article 8, 9, which give room to negotiate conditions as a choke point, where then companies play difficult and say, okay, I'll try to be as give as least as possible, invoke my trade secrets, have high compensation. That the mindset also has changed, but that's harder to determine, that the mindset shift has done, that we accept certain data we will no longer control, and we move our investment into innovation downstream on the algorithms, on the services. That would be my wish for 2026, but this will take probably 4 to 5 years.
Love the image of the button, my personal data, share my data button. Could be something that the EU as a concept exports into the rest and contributes to the rest of the world that's moving so fast. Wonderful. We're going to look forward to having another conversation in, say, 6 months.
Data Navigator, der Podcast zum EU Data Act.